Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network, and this hour we again talk about health care. The GOP health bill imploded in the Senate. The Senate bill's prospects collapsed last night after two senators, Mike Lee of Utah and Jerry Moran of Kansas, said they would vote against the motion to proceed on to debate on the most recent version of the measure. So now we have different kinds of plans on how to proceed. Mitch McConnell has said to repeal and replace Obamacare will not be successful. So he called for a repeal and then a two-year transition period to come up with a bill that's better than the one that wasn't going anywhere, isn't going anywhere right now. So he said that he would bring up a full repeal of the health care bill that was fashioned by the Democrats, and we'll see what happens with that. Donald Trump, in the meantime, has said a couple different things during the course of the morning. He said that he would demand Senate Republicans to have a straight repeal only, but then later he has said that he wants to let the ACA collapse and then rewrite health care law. So it's all up in the air right now, and I guess many people are wondering, what does it mean for my insurance? Will the ACA stay in place if there is a repeal? Are there votes for a repeal? And what does it mean to consumers of health care, which is all of us, if the ACA is repealed? Does it continue? Are there modifications to it? Will it fall apart, as the president has suggested? This hour of the program, we're going to be talking about all of this with Craig Garthwaite. He's an associate professor of strategy and director of the healthcare program at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. He wrote a very interesting piece. He's a lifelong Republican, and he spent months, he said, contemplating this question: why is replacing Obamacare so hard? And the title of his article is, "It's Fundamentally Conservative." Our phone number for you to join this conversation, many of you will want to do just that, I'm sure, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can find us on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Professor Garthwaite, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, a lot has happened today, so let's talk about the news of the day. Mitch McConnell saying that he will bring a full repeal of the ACA up for a vote and then a two-year period to fashion something else. Is a full repeal in danger as well?
I don't think so. I mean, if you sort of look at the most recent news, there are now three senators who have said that they wouldn't vote for that, for the motion to proceed on that as well, Collins, Murkowski, and Caputo. And then so that sort of puts us at that not going forward as well. That would be particularly bad policy. I didn't like the Senate bill, but it's a little bit of legislative malpractice to say that we're going to repeal Obamacare now, put a delay in, and then somehow our government's going to start working efficiently again, and we're going to come up with some solution.
The president, after saying something different, he said two different things. His latest is that he wants the ACA to collapse and then to rewrite the health care bill. He said he doesn't want to own it. It's not his.
Yeah, I mean, so there are a couple of things that we should think of for this. One, he might not want to own it, but at this point, I think the public sentiment is moving that what happens with health care going forward is going to be the Republicans, sort of on the Republicans' heads. And it's an interesting question as to whether that's a fair thing for the Republicans or not. On the one hand, this was a bill that was passed and drafted entirely by the Democrats in 2010. On the other hand, there are a number of decisions that the Republicans are making right now that are actually making the bill work far less effectively. And so whether or not we're going to enforce the individual mandate that people have to buy insurance, whether or not we're going to continue to fund what are called the cost-sharing subsidies that allow low-income people to have some relief from the high deductibles that come with many of the plans in the ACA. The Republicans won't say whether they'll continue to fund those. All of those are sowing uncertainty in the market,
right,
that are making it less likely to survive. And so in that sense, it is fair to say that if this law fails going forward, the Republicans, at least they deserve at least part of the blame for that.
Well, and the American public is going to be pretty upset if they have changes that lessen the ability to get health care.
I think they are, and I think there's going to be that's a very fair way for them to feel. I do think it's important, given the way that the Senate bill unfolded, that when we talk about the ACA failing, that we're very specific. But the part of the ACA that would fail, given President Trump's statement, are the exchanges in the individual market. They're not the Medicaid portion of the bill, which is working very well and will continue to work very well and is fully funded under the law. That's not going to fail on its own, and that really is where the majority of people under the ACA have gotten access to health insurance. It's through the Medicaid program. And so even in a world where I'm not happy to see the leader of our country rooting for any part of our country to fail, we should put some bounds around even what he's saying and what he can affect. And it really is just that individual exchange portion of the ACA.
Mm-hmm. Why is it that so much has been made of the fact that Republicans have called for repeal and replacing Obamacare during the whole campaign, even from the moment that Obamacare was passed? So there have been a number of years here. Are there so many different factions in the Republican Party that it makes it impossible for them to come up with a plan that would be better? This is a lot of years.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is the fact there are a number of factions in the party, and most importantly, that the Republican Party actually has a very slim majority in the Senate. And so it's not the case that they can really lose any meaningful number of senators and still get this passed. They really can't lose more than two, because they're not going to get any help from their opponents in repealing this bill. And so it doesn't take many factions actually to lose two members. Why they haven't come up with a solution? I mean, I think you know, there's the glib answer that the president gave, which, you know, nobody knew that healthcare was this complicated. But there is something to it, that actually coming up with a replacement for the ACA that covers as many people and is more conservative, there just isn't much room there for that to happen. And what I mean by that is that if you actually take a step back and take the politics out of it, take the feelings for President Obama, be they positive or negative, out of it, what you see is that the ACA is actually quite a conservative, or built on conservative principles. It uses a market-based system of allocating health insurance. People are signing up on exchanges that are offered by private firms that receive subsidies from the government. It really is in many ways very central to how you would think of an efficient conservative program being built that provides insurance to this many people. And that leaves you then with two options, right? You can either try and thread the needle to get just to the right of this and cover as many people, which is actually very hard and maybe not possible at all. Or you can say that you don't think you want to cover as many people as the ACA does. And the Republican Party, whether they believe that or not, is certainly unwilling to make that statement in public.
Mm-hmm.
And that leaves you in a place where you really can't come up with a solution that's more conservative, and therefore you don't get 50 votes.
Was it indeed fashioned by Mitt Romney?
I mean, so definitely there are huge parts of the ACA that are very similar to what is affectionately called Romney Care, which is the Massachusetts health reform bill. I do think there are fair arguments to be made that the financing and the nature of the Massachusetts reform was primarily paid for in large part by the federal government through the Medicaid program. And that's just not true when you do this federally to all the states. And so the ACA does include a large number of taxes that people are not particularly happy with. That was part of the conversation. So it's not identical to Romney Care. In addition, it's quite possible that people could believe that the types of things that make a good health insurance system in Massachusetts, which was a relatively healthy, relatively low uninsured state to start with, maybe aren't the same throughout, say, the Deep South, which has much lower levels of community health and much higher levels of uninsurance to start with.
Mm-hmm. Why is it that if you have the ACA, and it's becoming increasingly clear that people are involved in this system, many of them think the premiums are much too high, their health care costs, if you're not getting subsidies, have really gone up exponentially over the past few years, and people are complaining about that. So why isn't there, I'm asking a question, of course, about partisanship, but why can't, you know, Republicans and Democrats get together, and the Republicans who may be concerned about the aspects of the ACA that they don't like, and there are Democrats who want the ACA to be better. Is it just beyond the reach of possibility that that could happen, that Republicans and Democrats could look at this and maybe tweak the ACA?
I think that we might end up, that might be where we end up. It certainly wasn't where we were going to start, right? And so to the extent that the Republicans have ran the past 7 years on that we're going to repeal and replace Obamacare. I don't think we should expect that what we're going to get to start with there are the Democrats coming together and helping them do that. Now that the bill has failed, now that we're in a situation where we're having more of a conversation about the stability of the ACA marketplaces, there's room for a set of centrist Republicans and centrist Democrats to come together and do some common sense solutions to the ACA. These would include things like offering reinsurance to the insurance companies. So part of the ACA that we require is that insurers have to take everyone who shows up regardless of how healthy or sick they are. This is often called the ban on considering pre-existing conditions. Mm-hmm. This does result in a number of people who have known certain high medical expenses next year but are currently uninsured signing up for insurance and really running up the premiums for everyone else. If we as a society think that people should be able to do that, and I think that the polling suggests that is what we've decided,
yes,
then it's probably best for the federal government to help the insurers bear that expense, because insurance can't survive in a world in which it's a risk pool where people wait until they're sick and then show up to buy health insurance. Mm-hmm.
You've asked us in your article to consider our history. It seems you say even Ronald Reagan saw a role for government to provide quality health insurance for those who could not otherwise afford access.
Yeah, I mean, so and particularly what I was saying in the article is not our history as a nation, though it overlaps, it's our history as a party. I mean, as you said in the introduction, I am a lifelong member of the Republican Party. That over time has changed what that means, I think, the Republican Party, and it's gotten into a place where it is much more of a no government involvement in markets whatsoever party. And that really isn't where the party historically has been, because it's not a place that you can actually govern from. The health markets, particularly healthcare markets, require interventions of the government to provide the foundation necessary for the market to succeed. And then you'll end up, when it comes with healthcare, with some people who simply lack the resources to pay for access to health insurance, or pay for access to healthcare. And President Reagan realized that, and he was a supporter of what was originally called the Kerr-Mills Act, and what eventually became Medicaid when he was the governor of California. And then when he was president, he expanded Medicaid several times throughout his presidency to cover people such as pregnant women and their children, who we believe that if they don't have the resources, should get access to health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And so it isn't the case that the party's ever really been one of a complete lack of government involvement. It's meant to be one that is based on sort of fundamental economics and a belief about how we structure government programs to be most efficient, to provide the goals that we want, and how we use markets to get to those ends. That's where the party has traditionally been. And I hope that now, after this sort of realizing the silliness in some ways of trying to do this purely through repeal or purely through just repealing and taking the government entirely out of it, we can get to a place where we're once again an efficient governing party.
Craig, what's going to happen? We've heard one of the problems with the ACA is that there are quite a few states where there just aren't many insurers anymore. And so you've got one place and people are far from that place and there just aren't many people offering insurance. Can that be fixed, or are we just going to live with that for the foreseeable future?
I think we're going to live with it for the foreseeable future. I think it's important that we are careful with how we think about the statistics in this area. There's always the phrase of there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. This is a case where I think we see some of this. And in particular, there are a large number of counties in the United States in which people have access to only one insurer. But they represent a very small percentage of the population, or much smaller than that. So it's over a third of counties, but about 20% of the population. And why that's the case is actually part of what's led to the situation, is that most of the counties where this is happening are rural areas of the country where we've always had trouble providing really any service that has a high fixed cost, or particularly health care. And so this is not a problem that the ACA created. It's just saying it's that people have paid more attention to now that the ACA is around.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've heard people say, Republicans say, that a state like Iowa is down to one insurer. Is that not true?
Yes, Iowa is down to one insurer, but most of Iowa is pretty rural, and there aren't a lot of people that live there. And so in that sense, right, let's be clear, when we say they're down to one insurer, it's one insurer in the ACA marketplaces.
I see.
Of which there are only about 12 million people across the entire country that are enrolled in it. So it's not that Iowa as a state is down to one insurer. It's that only one insurer is offering an on-exchange product in Iowa. And so I think that for rhetoric purposes, that point is never emphasized by people who are against the ACA, but it is not that we're chasing insurers out of the market entirely.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Those people who are participating in the employer market and Medicare Advantage and Medicaid Managed Care, it's just in the ACA exchanges. And in rural areas, there just aren't many people in the exchange to get a really stable risk pool going.
And before we start going to phone calls, we're going to have many of them this hour, I want to talk a little bit more about the vision of the conservative wing of the party and the vision of the moderate wing of the party. When it comes to health care, is there any way to craft a Republican bill that's going to be able to unite those two parts of the party that seem to be at polar opposites in many ways?
I mean, I think there are things you could do to try and bring them together. So there's been talk among some people recently about basically national catastrophic insurance. And the idea being that part of what we should strive for is that you would never end up having a medical expense put you into bankruptcy. And so if you had medical expenses above some percentage of your income, there would be either through reinsurance or insurance programs or through an explicit government program, someone would pick up those medical costs for you. And then we would hope that a supplemental insurance market would wrap around that to help you pay for that deductible. So if you imagine something like you would never pay more than 15% of your income, let's say, and then you could buy an insurance plan that covered that first 15% of income. That would probably, as long as it kept the Medicaid program generally intact, be something that you would probably get some support from in both the moderate and the conservative wing of the party. And then the question just becomes whether that, you know, how much better is that than trying to fix the ACA? And maybe what is that we don't look for taking the moderate and the conservative end of the Republican Party and uniting it, but we take the moderate end of the Republican Party and the moderate end of the Democratic Party, and we have them work together.
Mm. And is that what you would suggest?
That's what I would hope. I mean, we used to have a time in this country in which we had people work across party lines, and particularly in healthcare. You know, I've sat with colleagues around lunch here, and we've chatted about different healthcare things we've done in the past. So the Hatch-Waxman Act, which creates broadly our generic drug market in the United States, contained a lot of both Democratic and Republican principles in the same bill. So when you leave a negotiation on that bill, you found like you've won on some things and you've lost on others. And we've got to be willing to accept that, but that's the way in which we get bipartisan progress here, is that you're going to win on some things, but you're going to lose on others. And then the bill will represent something like what the median American would hope for.
All right, let's go to phone calls in a moment and find out what our audience is thinking about this. The Republican plan, in case you somehow missed the news, is not going to happen. There weren't enough votes to even procedurally bring it to the floor. So Mitch McConnell is now saying that he's going to bring a full repeal of the ACA up for a vote. The president is saying that he wants to let the ACA collapse and then rewrite the health care law. What do you want? What do you think? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is at K Dunn Show. Our guest, Craig Garthwaite, is an associate professor of strategy and director of the healthcare program at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. This is the Ideas Network. All right, to phone calls, starting with Mark in Fort Atkinson. Hello, Mark.
Hello. I'm just wondering why they keep attacking the medical system from the cost point of view and never from the expense point of view. Why don't they do something about Paul Ryan years ago came up with this wonderful plan. He was planning on doing things about tort reform and all these things, and patent law, and all these things that were going to help bring medical costs under some sort of reasonable control. And it seems like all that's been pushed to the side, and all it has to do with beating up on the poor people that are trying to pay the bills.
That's an excellent question. Why don't we have an investigation of costs, Craig?
I mean, to be fair, over half of the ACA, right? So it's the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Over half the ACA does focus on questions of how we structure care to try and provide the right incentives to bring down costs. And so things like accountable care organizations, things like bundle payments, all are ways to try and make us make decisions about how to make the total health of the patient go up at a reasonable cost by providing the right incentives. On the other hand, things like tort reform, listen, I'm a Republican. I like tort reform. I think trial lawyers drive up the cost. I think we get more defensive medicine. But it's a few percentage points of what we're spending. It's not going to fundamentally reshape anything about how we spend in the United States. And so while I would love to see that pass, and I think it would be great, I just don't see it actually meaningfully moving the dial right now. Mm.
But has anybody done a really thorough examination of duplication of services, the number of hospitals in areas, how much people are paid, whether or not outside physicians are brought in that are not in your group, how many pills you're given, how many different procedures you're given? All of that really hasn't been very thoroughly examined, has it?
Oh no, we have a good sense broadly about sort of what we think is driving the cost of healthcare in the United States. We pay higher prices for things than other people. Some of that's a feature of the fact that the United States pays higher wages for everything, and wages are a big factor of the medical system, and that our lawyers get paid more than other countries as well, and it relates up from that. Some of it is about just market power, and so we have lots of hospitals that are effectively local monopolies, so I think it's less a question of, you know, having a large number of hospitals in area than it is having a small number of hospitals in area, where that hospital then has the ability to charge really high prices.
Mm-hmm.
The FTC, which is the governing body that pushes back on hospital mergers and antitrust, has had a remarkable sort of recent run of success of trying to stop, I think, mergers that would be anti-competitive, that would raise prices in these markets. And so we have a sense of where costs are high. Some of it is that we get lots of amenities when we go to the hospital, and Americans like that. We got lots of private rooms. We don't wait very long to get treatment for anything. All those things are quite expensive for us to have, and it's just a question of sort of whether we want to give those up to pay less. In general, Americans don't seem to like to give things up to, even if we're going to pay less. We seem to want to have both the really high level of service we've got and all of the drugs and all of the access to physicians, and we just want to pay less money. And there's got to be a fundamental trade-off there.
Well, they don't want to pay $10 for Tylenol, though, right?
Yeah, but a lot of the stories of $10 for Tylenol, listen, there's certainly things with Tylenol combined with other products, but it's about you're sort of allocating the fixed cost of running a hospital into an itemized bill. And so I don't think we should read too much into sort of what those numbers mean on a hospital bill, that you're actually paying $10 for that as you're paying for $10 getting it in that setting.
And yet, I want to explore this just a little more. There are a number of people who are going to foreign countries to have surgeries done, to have needed care taken care of, because the cost may be a third of what it is in U.S. health care. So can't we look at some other countries and say, what are you doing right that we're not doing right?
And often what they're doing is they're having the government use its market power, as we refer to as a monopsonist, right? So we know we tend to use the term or be familiar with the term monopolist, right? Monopolist is one seller for many buyers. A monopsonist is one buyer for many sellers. And just like a monopoly ends up with really high prices, a monopsony ends up with artificially low prices because the one buyer uses its power to push down prices in the market. And that has a lot of negative effects as well that we should be very clear about, right? It decreases the incentive for innovation. It decreases the number of people that want to go into a profession if we artificially hold down their wages. And as I said, it's a conversation we can have, but it involves meaningful trade-offs that it's not clear that all Americans necessarily want to make.
We have an email from Gary who wants to know, how does pharmaceutical advertising play in? We're the only country in the world that allows it. Is that driving up our health costs?
Listen, much like tort reform, pharmaceutical pricing or pharmaceutical advertising definitely has some expense to it. It is not meaningfully driving up the prices that are paid or the spending we have on healthcare. And depending upon what drug is being advertised, there can be quite positive effects. So one of my colleagues here, Amanda Stark, who's an economist here at Kellogg with me, has a really nice paper looking at the advertising for Lipitor. And given how effective Lipitor is at affecting people's cardiovascular health, that the advertising and the increase in the use of Lipitor and its generic competitors as a result actually increased the sort of health and welfare of society. And so I don't I understand why people like to point to prescription drug advertising, but it's a relatively small expense in the system. I don't think you can point to that as a reason why we're spending so much in the United States.
Mark, thanks for your call. Let's go to Joe in Lake Geneva. Hi, Joe.
Hello.
Hi.
I think we're somewhat beating a dead horse when we look at the ACA versus a repeal and replace. How about we look at medical costs? If we're 75th out of 300 countries, yet we pay more than any other country, and the quality of care, we're down to 75th. My example is I was in atrial fibrillation. I went into intensive care. They let me leave on 12 drugs. They had a Lyme's test pending. We can do a Lyme. I'm a veterinarian. We can do a Lyme's test on your dog and give you results in 10 minutes that are 99% accurate. Yet they don't have that same thing. The doctor that referred me in said, "Here, give me a couple $100. I got a quarter. I'll flip it and I'll give you a Lyme's test." Well, he's mocking the Lyme's test. Mine came back negative. While I had Lyme disease, had to go to an alternative practitioner to get care. And if insurance doesn't cover that, and you're sick and tired of getting, you know, messed about by the, you know, the big business of hospitals and so on, well, they're not trying to cure you. And if we did that as veterinarians to farmers, we'd put them out of business. How about cure the disease instead of treat it better, better, better?
Okay.
A lot to unpack there. So I think let's take a step back and sort of the frustration I think you have as to this cure versus treat idea. And I think one thing that's important to think about that you're getting at is that at times we might feel that the incentives within healthcare are misaligned. And so one thing within the ACA, right, is an attempt to create what are called accountable care organizations, a term I mentioned earlier. And at a very broad level, what these are is making a hospital or a health provider responsible for the total health or the total medical spending of a patient for the year. And so imagine that given your age and gender, we expect that you're going to spend about $10,000 next year. The hospital is given, is sort of assigned you as a life, and they say, well, if I'm able to treat you and keep you healthy and have you only consume $8,000 worth of medical services, I can keep some portion of the savings. And it gets to sort of what I think the caller's frustration was of that provides the hospital with the incentive to treat the health of you, not just prescribe an individual set of things that they end up getting paid for.
Thanks, Joe, for your call. Jesse in Madison, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a couple of comments. I missed the caller before, so I don't know what I said, but I'm an RN patient advocate, and I've been an RN for 25 years. A couple of things are when I go to the ER with patients, they order a CAT scan for somebody who has memory loss that's been on a medication for 3 years. That's for memory loss. And if I'm not there, they're very insistent that this gets done, when clearly it doesn't need to be. The CAT scan for their head does not need to be done as they have known memory problems. And additionally, we practice disease management. We don't really teach people how to be healthy. And I was wondering if that has ever come into any conversations about shifting what kind of so-called health care we give people.
Well, I mean, I will say that you're getting an idea of sort of population health or preventative health. The idea being that if we can give people the right information or the right incentives to take care of themselves, we can then avoid a number of the negative consequences of the disease if the disease never emerges. And that broadly is the area that you're in. Certainly the incentive system I'm talking about with an ACO or accountable care organization gets at that idea, because if your ACO can, you know, get someone healthy through information, it's cheaper than actually treating them. The general fact, though, is that if you look at the totality of the evidence, we don't get a very good return on population health when it's done sort of writ large for the population. And we just don't, it costs a lot of money and people don't actually modify their behavior. We'd like it if that wasn't true, but I think that we have, to date, not really seen a great set of population health interventions that lead to really what you're looking for is decreased spending. We might get some improved health, but we certainly don't get the decreased spending that we would hope we would get.
If you have government-run systems like the VA, like Medicare, like Medicaid, like Medicare B, and then you get the prescription drug Medicare D. And for the most part, people seem to be quite pleased with those. Why not move into a government-run system for everybody? Those programs are working well, aren't they?
I mean, I would say sort of the past several years of the VA would not suggest that people are meaningfully happy with all of the care that they get there in terms of waiting lists and access to care. And we're currently trying to rethink about how we deal with access to care in the VA. It's certainly the case that the population that we have on Medicare and to a lesser degree Medicaid is happy with sort of their access to care. The question becomes, if writ large we had the entire population paying those reimbursement rates, we would effectively be taking a big chunk of money out of the system. And whether people want to admit or not, there is going to be a cost to that shows up, and it's going to show up in either having fewer hospitals, having hospitals that are at greater capacity with longer waiting lists, or it's going to show up with people not wanting to go into the physician profession as much because it doesn't pay as much money. We can have that conversation as society. As economists, I think we're very happy to have that conversation about what trade-offs we're willing to accept. What we can't have is some belief that we can take that amount of money out of the system and that there are no negative repercussions that will come from it.
And yet, again, we're looking at other countries in the world, and almost everybody else does that.
And they have longer waiting lists for treatments, and they have physicians that are paid meaningfully less. I think they have accepted a different degree of trade-off. They also, when it comes to the purchase of prescription drugs, have the luxury that we don't have of the profits in the United States providing incentives for innovation in those countries, incentive for innovations for products that will then flow to those countries that pay lower prices. So drugs developed to sell for high profits in the U.S. are then subsequently sold in other countries for much lower profits. I think many of us would like a world where we spend a little bit less on prescription drugs and everyone else spends a little bit more and we still get the same level of innovation. I just don't think many people believe that that's actually what would happen. And if we cut back spending, the governments of Western Europe would increase their spending to accommodate the loss in profit that comes from the U.S. decision.
So those countries don't do research on their own about drugs?
Oh, no, they do research because they all want to sell it to the United States market as well. I'll be very clear what I said. It's not U.S. companies. It's not that I have some belief that U.S. companies have some ability to develop drugs better than anyone else. We have a large number of foreign firms that make really great medications that treat a wide variety of indications, but their primary goal is to sell it for high profits in the United States.
Let's go next. Thanks, Jesse, for your call. Muhammad in Madison. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. You know, I was telling your screener that I wonder why I don't hear enough talked about the Affordable Care Act. For example, you probably know about the company here in Madison called Epic. They're pretty much one of the leaders in the paperless medical record system. I never heard a president talk about that before President Obama. How much money that has saved, how many mistakes have been prevented where you go to the doctor now, and your doctor doesn't have to write out in hieroglyphics your medication that you need that somebody might misread and misprescribe you. If they hit a button, and your prescription is printed out, plain English. You don't hear it talked about the five A's that I've never heard about before, the Affordable Care Act, which is when you go to a doctor or any health facility, they have to ask you five questions regarding tobacco use, whether you would like to quit, would you like to, a counseling, medications or whatever. The people who didn't have insurance before have it now. We just hear about the people who can't afford their premiums. Their premiums are going up. The majority of the people that are getting the Affordable Care Act didn't have any coverage before. Mm-hmm. And the Democrats almost seem, I hate to use this frame of reference, but impotent when it comes to defending something that they say they support. So that's my question. I never hear this from most people when they talk about health care in the United States.
Thanks, Muhammad. Professor Garthwaite.
Well, I mean, so I guess I would just pretty much disagree with some of the premise of what you say. I do agree that we have seen increasing the use of electronic medical records, and those are going to increase maybe perhaps quality of care. I think it's a more debatable belief about the benefits of that in a clinical setting. If you talk to any physician, right, and you mentioned the term EPIC, it won't be the full-throated defense that Muhammad just gave us, right? They tend to very much dislike that company and the record system because it's created a lot of additional burden they feel about treating patients. I think physicians oversell that case. I think that it is good that we have electronic medical records, that we haven't figured out a really good way to have them work together across systems so I can really take my record from one hospital to another. Often they're on different systems, so I can't do that. In terms of the second half of what the caller said, in terms of the, you know, no one defending the ACA, I don't think that really is a fair representation of what we've seen in the country over the past 4 months. I think there's been a very strong and full-throated defense of the ACA. And if you think about it, right, that's really resulted in the attempt at repealing and replacing the bill dying last night. The Republicans have control of the House, the Senate, and the presidency, and they've been unable to get the support to get their one signature policy promise, which is that they would repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. I think a lot of that is because people are talking about the increase in access to insurance that people got via Medicaid or the exchanges under the ACA.
Yeah, a lot of people have found it very helpful.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Muhammad, for the call. We go to Tom in Amherst. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you?
Fine. How are you, Tom?
I'm doing well.
Good.
Thanks.
Good.
Say, my comment has to do with, I think, part of the problem when we look at healthcare is in that much of the discussion about policy has to do with numbers and money. And we need to get away from that model and start talking about ethics and morality in terms of, you know, my belief is that everyone all across the world deserves healthcare. And we need to start looking and framing the questions and solutions around a moral and ethical guideline as opposed to just number crunching everything.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. Do we start from that question? Have we answered that affirmatively in this country that people who live in this country deserve health care? Craig?
So I think that if you look at the polling, the country's definitely moved far more in that direction over the last 8 years than it ever has before. And so there is sort of a moral statement about we want people to have access to health care. What that means, I think, is actually quite different across different people about what does access to health care actually mean? Is it preventative health care? Is it emergency health care? I also think that while I understand the desire of framing healthcare as a moral or an ethical question, you cannot understate the fact that it is, in the end, a market transaction between different individuals. And therefore, we have to think about the numbers. And that's true even if you have national health insurance, right? You think about the numbers, you just think about them in a different way. And so drugs that are too expensive in the UK market, for example, the committee there, the National Institute on Comparative Effectiveness, often called NICE, says we just won't pay for that drug. That drug won't be available to people. And so it's not like you can just ignore the numbers. The other thing you have to think about, and this is where it becomes hard when it comes, we think about the idea about what innovation do we lose if we try and cut back profits in healthcare, is what is the price of a drug that doesn't exist today? I do a lot of work talking to people about the drug Sovaldi, which has been very controversial, but it was a cure for hepatitis C. And basically, it's controversial because the company Gilead charged $90,000 for the cure. But prior to that point, right, prior to the cure existing, the price was infinite. We had no access to a cure for hepatitis C. And so we have to think carefully about what it means to have access to healthcare. Is it access today to the technology that exists today? Is it access to the promise of future technology? Before we say that all this is an ethical question.
Hmm. Well, I think, you know, on a basic level, it means being able to make sure that if you have something serious happen to you, you can have an operation at a hospital and not go in debt, or you can go see a doctor and get some treatment when you're sick. That's not asking too much, is it?
It's not. I don't think it's asking too much, but I think you have to think carefully about what treatment actually means here, right? Let's imagine a world in which what we had is what we had before the ACA, in which hospitals provided charity care to low-income people, and then we attempted to reimburse the hospital for the cost of providing that care. right? And people who had emergency situations had the ability to get care for effectively no cost at the hospital. They had to then figure out the charity care aspect of it, or they had to not be able to pay the bad debt portion, but they weren't left to die in the streets. The question is that a more or less efficient program than doing it via Medicaid? I tend to think of Medicaid as providing good access to hospitals for people. But one of the primary things that Medicaid does is it involves a transfer of resources from the government to the hospital for things they otherwise would do, which is treat low-income people who come in regardless of their ability to pay. That's fine. I have no problem with that being what Medicaid is. But it does make you then start to question about what was the true lack of access to care beforehand.
We're going to take more phone calls in a moment. Professor Craig Garthwaite is our guest, Associate Professor of Strategy and Director of the Healthcare Program at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. Wrote a piece that caught our attention, Why Replacing Obamacare is So Hard, It's Fundamentally Conservative. This is the Ideas Network. All right, let's go back to phone calls, and we go to Charlie in Milwaukee next. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, thank you. As your guest had mentioned, it appears that the Affordable Care Act has been defended over the last several months quite vigorously, but yet we forget that it was imploding prior to the election. How much money will it take to make the Affordable Care Act, as it currently is, viable to make it work? And secondly, in terms of adding competition, I look at like LASIK as the answer. I mean, several years ago it was so expensive, but soon as it became, the price was known and people were actually competing for the patients requiring LASIK, the price of the procedure came down dramatically. Isn't the answer to have more competition, not less like in a single payer, the real answer for our healthcare? Thank you.
Yeah, well, you'd have some government controls on the price, though, too. But let's go back to his first statement. Is the ACA imploding?
No, I think there's no sense in which you can say the ACA is imploding. So what we saw before the election, this is actually some work I've done with my colleague John Graves at Vanderbilt. What we saw before the election was that there was there are a number of firms that left the ACA marketplaces. It was very public. In particular, United and Aetna left the ACA marketplaces, and people were concerned that suggested, well, if United and Aetna can't succeed, who could succeed in the marketplace? Because we all know United and Aetna as a brand name. The reality of it is that the companies that are exiting are those who have business models that really weren't amenable to a state-based exchange market for low-income people, whereas the companies that are succeeding are people who have previously served in similar roles in Medicaid managed care, right? So companies like Centene and Molina, two of the companies that have done the best in the ACA marketplaces, are people that have previously served as Medicaid managed care companies working with low-income populations to provide low-cost health care to them, and those are companies that have done very well. And it shouldn't be that every company that enters a new market succeeds, right? If we talk about sort of the benefits of competition, as the caller was interested in, competition entails both people succeeding and people failing. And just because United does well providing employer health insurance to people doesn't mean they should also do well providing low-income insurance in the ACA. When it comes to the idea of introducing more price competition through LASIK or other things, there are certainly areas of the healthcare economy where we can and do want to see that, and we have seen that through things like bundle payments for a knee and hip surgery, where we've tried to introduce some degree of price competition. We should note, though, that it's a market where it's actually quite tough to have the true kind of competition that you're looking for, because the customer often doesn't have a lot of information about
right.
quality, and we have difficulty communicating that quality. That doesn't mean we shouldn't introduce it anywhere, right? But we should focus on places where we think that competition can be very useful. So CalPERS, which is the California Retirement System, right? They have introduced a system of what's called reference pricing for a number of procedures like MRIs or colonoscopies or knee and hip replacements, things that are discrete interactions with the medical community that have relatively easy to understand quality metrics. And what reference pricing is they set a price, say, you know, the 60th percentile price in a community, say for a knee and hip surgery, like $30,000. And they say, listen, if you find a provider, and here's a list of high quality providers that will do it for $30,000 or less, you don't have to pay anything. If you want to go to a fancy brand name academic medical center who's going to charge you $60,000 for it, that's fine as well, we'll still pay $30,000, and then you're responsible for the rest. And so there are areas of the health system where we want to introduce competition in this way, but we want to do it in a way that has respect for the fact that information is not equally held across different people within the market, and therefore we need to have some guardrails and some protections that either provide more information or protect customers from being taken advantage of.
Mm-hmm. Well, we also don't think of price when we're doing all of our health care, right? I mean, what you just said is very interesting. We should really know what the price of all of these things is. What is it going to cost to have a hip replacement? Usually we just go to the place our doctor tells us to go to, and we don't look at the price of all of this. If we did, maybe it might be a little different, huh?
Well, it's not just price. It's sort of quality-adjusted price is what you want to think of, and that's where it becomes difficult. If it was just shopping on price, we could do that easily, but it's not like every knee and hip surgery are exactly the same in terms of quality across the different people providing it. And so we have difficulty communicating that quality. We've tried doing things like report cards on hospitals and report cards on surgeons. My colleague David Dranoff here, one of my sort of smartest colleagues in the building, what he found is that when you do that, hospitals and doctors try and game that system to get better scores. And so it's just not easy for us to actually provide really high-quality information, or sort of accurate and easy-to-understand information about the quality of different providers.
Let's go next to Ken. Thanks, Charlie, for your call. Ken in Michigan. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question and a comment regarding the economic viability of the way that we're doing things, as opposed to doing something along the lines of some type of single-payer system. Right now, we're paying for this anyway. Businesses have this as a very, very high cost to their bottom line. It did take Chrysler down. This is such a high cost for healthcare and for their retirees and current employees. That's what caused Daimler to take them. We're paying for this anyway. This is spread across the total population. Doesn't this give more money for our businesses to put into R&D and be more competitive? After all, a real competition is not China per se. It's Western Europe. We don't have to have a Canadian or British-style system. We can have a very American system. And, Kathleen, you had, a year's worth of programs on the different types of health care around the world. There's some very unique things out there that we could make on our own.
Yeah, we've done a lot of shows on health care for years and years and years and years now. Professor Garthwaite, what do you think? Something peculiarly American?
There's a lot of just sort of ambiguity in what the caller is talking about, that we can have a single-payer system that's peculiarly American and not like those that exist in other countries. In the end, if we're going to save money, how we're going to save money is pulling profits and pulling money out of the healthcare system. I don't mean to sound like a broken record in getting back to this. Maybe it's because I'm an economist and we think of things in very, very particular ways, but there's going to be a trade-off to that. And as I said a number of times so far, we can debate whether we want to have that trade-off, but it's not that we go to this sort of particular American system that we create, we pull all of these profits out of the health system, and then all of a sudden we get the same results at a lower cost. That's not what's going to happen. There's not that much fat in the system, right? There are things about our system that are different from other countries that lots of people like. Right? I think lots of people like when they go to the hospital and they don't have to share a room. That is a uniquely American system in many ways, right? The degree to which we do that.
Yeah, but that's all new. People used to share rooms all the time. What's the big deal?
That's fine. You can say, what's the big deal? I'm telling you what customers actually want when they go to the hospital as patients.
Yeah. Well, we are out of time. Thank you so much for being with us. It was a really interesting hour and lots of interest in this topic. We could do show after show on this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Professor Craig Garthwaite, Associate Professor of Strategies, Director of the Healthcare Program at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. Thanks to Gretchen Brown for producing this hour, and to Gretchen as well for on-air production.